three-dimensional boundary, separating its three-dimensional interior from its exterior, while its edges form a closed one-dimensional boundary, separating its faces from each other. But now the blue arrows cancel out at every edge, and the one-dimensional boundary of the two-dimensional boundary of the tetrahedron is zero. So for both the 2D disk and the 3D tetrahedron, the boundary of the boundary is zero. While physicists often use this rule to explain the conservation of energy momentum, or as Wheeler calls it, momenergy, it can be more generally interpreted with respect to information and constraint, or state and syntax. That is, the boundary is analogous to a constraint which separates an interior attribute satisfying the constraint from a complementary exterior attribute, thus creating an informational distinction. No question? No answer. In a quantum experiment, the measuring device and its placement correspond to a question and the result to its answer. The existence of the answer, consisting of information on state, is predicated on the asking of the question or the occurrence of the measurement, and the kind of answer received depends on the kind of question asked and the manner in which it is posed. The world is thus composed of measurement events in which information is exchanged by objects, one or both of which ask a question, and one or both of 10 which give an answer. Question and answer, the stimulation and observation of an event, cannot be separated on the ontological level, and they cannot be shielded from the influence of the environment. At the root of this criterion are quantum uncertainty and complementarity, the foundation stones of quantum mechanics. The super-Copernican principle. Just as Copernicus displaced geocentricity with heliocentricity, showing by extension that no particular place in the universe is special, and thereby repudiating here-centeredness, the super-Copernican principle says that no particular point in time is special, repudiating now-centeredness. Essentially, this means that where observer participation functions retroactively, the participatory burden is effectively distributed throughout time. So although the bit size of the universe is too great to have been completely generated by the observer participants who have thus far existed, future generations of observer participants, possibly representing modes of observer participation other than that associated with human observation, have been and are now weighing in from the future. The relevance of this principle to the participatory anthropic principle is self-evident. Consciousness. Wheeler emphasizes the difficulty of making a general distinction between the form of information processing characteristic of humans and that characteristic of various complex systems and devices that may or may not be conscious. The line between the unconscious and the conscious begins to fade, he states. We may someday have to enlarge the scope of what we mean by a who. The term who, he suggests, is too specific to man, life, and consciousness. Its anthropic connotations are anti-Copernican, while the concepts of life and consciousness are subject to revision as science advances. It would seem more reasonable, he suggests, to dismiss for the present the semantic overtones of who and explore and exploit the insights to be won from the phrases communication and communication employed to establish meaning. More is different. The potential for complexity increases with cardinality. With large numbers of elements comes combinatorial variety and the potential for the sort of multi-level logical structure that typifies biological organisms and modern computers alike. This is a fundamental precept of complexity theory. Wheeler poses a question: will we someday understand time and space and all the other features that distinguish physics and existence itself as the self-generated organs of a self-synthesized information system? Together, these pithy slogans, questions, precautions, and clues add up to a call for a new strain of reality theory, a unified conceptual model for our thoughts and observations. How many of the models currently being held forth respond to this call? The answer, of course, is almost none. While some of them seem to address one or two of the questions and meet one or two of the criteria, none comes close to addressing and meeting all of them. What each model has been forced to give in order to meet any small subset of criteria has cost it dearly in terms of meeting the others. Thus, we have thesis and antithesis in the form of classical physics and discrete quantum models, but because the full depth of the relationship between the two is unfathomed, no synthesis. Virtually everybody seems to acknowledge the correctness of Wheeler's insights, but the higher order relationships required to put it all together in one big picture have proven elusive. The logical difficulty of answering all of the questions and meeting all of the criteria at once, in parallel, using integrated, logically tractable concepts, has simply been prohibitive. Can this situation be redressed? Some additional principles. Although insights regarding the ideal and/or perceptual basis of reality go back millennia, we may as well start with some of their more recent proponents for the sake of continuity. First, Descartes posited that reality is mental in the sense of rationalism, but contradicted his own thesis by introducing mind-body dualism, the notion that mind and matter are irreducibly separate. The empiricist Berkeley then said that reality is perceptual in nature, a kind of intersect of mind and matter. This can be seen by mentally subtracting perception from one's conception of reality. What remains is pure subjective cognition, but without any objective grist for the perceptual mill. Although attempts to cognitively subtract cognition from reality are far more common, they are a bit like trying to show that a sponge is not inherently wet while immersing it in water, and can never be successful on the parts of cognitive entities. Hume then attempted to do away with cognition and causation entirely, asserting that both mind and matter inhere in perception and exist apart from neither it nor each other. In disposing of mind, Hume made another salient contribution to reality theory. He attempted to dispose of causation by identifying it as a cognitive artifact, supporting his thesis with the problem of induction. The problem of induction states that because empirical induction entails the prior assumption of that which it seeks to establish, namely the uniformity of nature, science is circular and fundamentally flawed. The problem of induction is very real. It is manifest in Heisenberg uncertainty and the cosmic horizon problem, finite limitations of scientific tools of microscopic and macroscopic observation, and is why no general theory of reality can ever be reliably constructed by the standard empirical methods of science. Unfortunately, many scientists have either dismissed this problem or quietly given up on the search for a truly general theory, in neither case serving the long-term interests of science. In fact, the problem of induction merely implies that a global theory of reality can only be established by the rational methods of mathematics, specifically including those of logic. In response to Berkeley and Hume, Kant asserted that the unprimed cognition which remains when perceptual content is subtracted has intrinsic structure that exists prior to content. It comprises the a priori categories of perceptual or phenomenal reality. 24. Unfortunately, subtracting perception according to Kantian rules yields more than unprimed cognition. It also yields noumena, absolute objects or things in themselves. On one side of the result is a perceptual isomorphism between the mind and phenomenal reality. On the other yawns a chasm on the far side of which sits an unknowable but nonetheless fundamental noumenal reality, which Kant evidently regarded as the last word in sub-theological reality theory. However, Kant's chasm is so deep and wide, and so thoroughly interdicts any mind-reality isomorphism, that it precludes causal efficacy, and for that matter, any other comprehensible principle of correspondence. This implies that noumena are both rationally and empirically irrelevant to cognitive and perceptual reality, and thus that they can be safely eliminated from reality theory. Whatever Kant had in mind when he introduced the concept of a noumenon, his definition essentially amounts to inconceivable concept, and is thus an oxymoron. Whatever he really meant, we must rely on something other than Kantian metaphysics to find it. Thus far, we have managed to narrow reality down to the phenomenal reality studied by science, a combination of perceptual content and rational principles of cognition. A scientist employs empirical methods to make specific observations, applies general cognitive relationships from logic and mathematics in order to explain them, and comes off treating reality as a blend of perception and cognition. But this treatment lacks anything resembling an explicit justification. When a set of observations is explained with a likely set of equations interpreted therein, the adhesion between explanandum and explanation might as well be provided by rubber cement. I.e., scientific explanations and interpretations glue observations and equations together in a very poorly understood way. It often works like a charm. But why? One of the main purposes of reality theory is to answer this question. The first thing to notice about this question is that it involves the process of attribution, and that the rules of attribution are set forth in stages by mathematical logic. The first stage is called sentential logic and contains the rules for ascribing the attributes true or false, respectively denoting inclusion or non-inclusion in arbitrary cognitive perceptual systems, to hypothetical relationships in which predicates are linked by the logical functors not, and or, implies, and if and only if. Sentential logic defines these functors as truth functions assigning truth values to such expressions irrespective of the contents, but not the truth values, of their predicates, thus affecting a circular definition of functors on truth values and truth values on functors. The next stage of attribution, predicate logic, ascribes specific properties to objects using quantifiers. And the final stage, model theory, comprises the rules for attributing complex relations of predicates to complex relations of objects, i.e., theories to universes. In addition, the form of attribution called definition is explicated in a theory-centric branch of logic called formalized theories, and the mechanics of functional attribution is treated in recursion theory. In sentential logic, a tautology is an expression of functor-related sentential variables that is always true, regardless of the truth values assigned to its sentential variables themselves. A tautology has three key properties. It is universally, syntactically true. It is thus self-referential, true even of itself, and therefore closed under recursive self-composition, and its implications remain consistent under inferential operations preserving these properties. That is, every tautology is a self-consistent circularity of universal scope, possessing validity by virtue of closure under self-composition, comprehensiveness, non-exclusion of truth, and consistency, freedom from irresolvable paradox. But tautologies are not merely consistent unto themselves. They are mutually consistent under mutual composition, making sentential logic as much a self-consistent circularity of universal scope as any one of its tautologies. Thus, sentential logic embodies two levels of tautology, one applying to expressions and one applying to theoretical systems thereof. Predicate logic then extends the tautology concept to cover the specific acts of attribution represented by formerly anonymous sentential variables, and model theory goes on to encompass more complex of attribution involving more complex relationships. Reality theory is about the stage of attribution in which two predicates analogous to true and false, namely real and unreal, are ascribed to various statements about the real universe. In this sense, it is closely related to sentential logic. In particular, sentential logic has four main properties to be emulated by reality theory. The first is absolute truth. As the formal definition of truth, it is true by definition. The other properties are closure, comprehensiveness, and consistency. I.e., logic is wholly based on and defined strictly within the bounds of cognition and perception. It applies to everything that can be coherently perceived or conceived, and it is by its very nature consistent, being designed in a way that precludes inconsistency. It is the basis of mathematics, being the means by which propositions are stated, proved, or disproved, and it is the core of science, underwriting the integrity of rational and empirical methodology. Even so-called non-standard logics, e.g. modal, fuzzy, and many-valued logics, must be expressed in terms of fundamental two-valued logic to make sense. In short, two-valued logic is something without which reality could not exist. If it were eliminated, then true and false, real and unreal, and existence and non-existence could not be distinguished, and the merest act of perception or cognition would be utterly impossible. Thus far, it has been widely assumed that reality theory can be sought by the same means as any other scientific theory. But this is not quite true, for while science uses the epistemological equivalent of magic glue to attach its theories to its observations, reality theory must give a recipe for the glue and justify the means of application. That is, reality theory must describe reality on a level that justifies science, and thus occupies a deeper level of explanation than science itself. Does this mean that reality theory is mathematical? Yes, but since mathematics must be justified along with science, metamathematical would perhaps be a better description. And when all is said and done, This comes down to logic, pure and simple. It follows that reality theory must take the form of an extended logic, in fact, a limiting form of logic, in which the relationship between theory and universe, until now an inexhaustible source of destructive model theoretic ambiguity, is at last reduced to dual aspect monic form, short-circuiting the paradox of Cartesian dualism and eliminating the epistemological gap between mind and matter, theory and universe. As complexity rises and predicates become theories, tautology and truth become harder to recognize. Because universality and specificity are at odds in practice, if not in principle, they are subject to a kind of logical decoherence associated with relational stratification. Because predicates are not always tautological, they are subject to various kinds of ambiguity. As they become increasingly specific and complex, it becomes harder to locally monitor the heritability of consistency and locally keep track of the truth property in the course of attribution, or even after the fact. Undecidability, LSAT intractability, and NP completeness, predicate ambiguity, and the Loewenheim-Skolem theorem, observational ambiguity, and the Duhem-Quine thesis, these are some of the problems that emerge once the truth predicate decoheres with respect to complex attributive mappings. It is for reasons like these that the philosophy of science has fallen back on falsificationist doctrine, giving up on the tautological basis of logic, effectively demoting truth to provisional status, and discouraging full appreciation of the tautological syntactic level of scientific inquiry, even in logic and philosophy themselves. In fact, the validity of scientific theories, and of science as a whole, absolutely depends on the existence of a fundamental reality theoretic framework spanning all of science, a fundamental syntax from which all scientific and mathematical languages and the extended cognitive language of perception itself can be grammatically unfolded, cross-related, and validated. Tautology, the theoretical basis of truth as embodied in sentential logic, is obviously the core of this syntax. Accordingly, reality theory must be developed through amplification of this tautological syntax by a junction of additional syntactic components, the principles of reality theory, which leave the overall character of the syntax invariant. Specifically, in order to fashion a reality theory that has the truth property in the same sense as does logic, but permits the logical evaluation of statements about space and time and law, we must adjoin principles of extension that lend meaning to such statements while preserving the tautology property. According to the nature of sentential logic, truth is tautologically based on the integrity of cognitive and perceptual reality. Cognition and perception comprise the primitive, self-definitive basis of logic, and logic comprises the rules of structure and inference under which perception and cognition are stable and coherent. So when we say that truth is heritable under logical rules of inference, we really mean that tautology is heritable, and that the primitive cognitive perceptual basis of sentential logic thus maintains its primary status. By converting tautologies into other tautologies, the rules of inference of sentential logic convert cognitive perceptual invariants into other such invariants. To pursue this agenda in reality theory, we must identify principles that describe how the looping structure of logical tautology is manifest in various reality theoretic settings and contexts on various levels of description and interpretation. That way, we can verify its preservation under the operations of theoretic reduction and extension, i.e., we must adjoin generalized principles of loop structure to logical syntax in such a way that more and more of reality is thereby explained and comprehensiveness is achieved. For example, take the sentential tautology x v x, x or not x. Applied to perception, this means that when something is seen or observed, it is not seen in conjunction with its absence. If it were, then two contradictory perceptions would coincide, resulting in a splitting off of perceptual realities. In effect, either the consciousness of the perceiver would split into two separate cognitive realities in a case of chain reactive dissociation, or the perceiver himself would physically split along with physical reality. When XVX is composed with other tautologies or itself by substitution, the stakes are exactly the same. Any violation of the compound tautology would split perceptual and cognitive reality with disastrous implications for its integrity. After its tautological nature, The first thing to note about sentential logic in the context of reality theory is that against the spirit